Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear about former President Barack Obama holding a secret meeting with a Hoosier Democrat. You'll get the latest on the Noblesville Middle School shooting. Sharon Jackson reports on a deadline extension to apply for FEMA disaster recovery assistance. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Jamie Williams from Ameristar Casino about their new landslide gaming area. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, dredging of a ship canal in Northwest Indiana has begun as environmental regulators continue to study off-site disposal options for highly contaminated settlements. The Times reported U.S. Army Corps of Engineers contractors began dredging work at the Indiana Harbor Ship Canal in East Chicago on Monday. The Corps said removing the 120,000 cubic yards of sediment will likely finish in the fall. Natalie Mills, project manager for the Army Corps, said sediment containing more than 50 parts per million of polychlorinated biphenyls won't be dredged until off-site disposal is finalized. PCBs are cancer-causing chemicals once used in a wide range of products, from electrical appliances to fluorescent lighting. The Army Corps has applied for a Toxic Substances Control Act permit to store the material at a confined disposal site near East Chicago Central High School and the new Kerry Ghosh Elementary School. Environmental activists and residents fought the proposal, arguing the city is already overburdened with toxic industrial contamination. The EPA and the State Department of Environmental Management are conducting a feasibility study and remedial design for removal of the settlement. The EPA said the study is ongoing. The TSCA permit application is pending, according to the Army Corps. They go on to say that dredging the most contaminated sediments would likely begin next year if the study determines that off-site disposal is feasible. The Grand Calumet River and Indiana Harbor Ship Canal were first labeled as an area of concern in 1987. The area has sediments with toxic and cancer-causing substances such as heavy metals and polysilic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are also cancer-causing compounds. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Construction is proceeding on the replacement for a major Northwest Indiana bridge that will improve access to major industries, casinos, the Gary Chicago International Airport, and growing recreational opportunities along Lake Michigan. The Times reports more than a third of the new Klein Avenue Bridge's 29 piers are in place. The East Chicago span will carry traffic 100 feet above the Indiana Harbor Ship Canal. Construction on the privately owned and operated toll bridge began last July. It's scheduled to open to traffic in January 2020. About 160 people are working on it. The original Klein Avenue Bridge was closed in 2009 by the state after it determined the structure had been weakened by corrosion to the point that it was no longer safe. Its demolition was completed in early 2013. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Tom Maloney.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. For more breaking news, here's Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney.
A Gary school board member is criticizing the state's decision to strip the board of most of its powers. The school board held its final meeting on Tuesday, where the board will now become an unpaid advisory unit next month and meet four times annually, according to the Post Tribune. Its first meeting will be September 12th. The district's emergency manager, Peggy Hinckley, isn't required to meet with the advisory board. She's instead required to hold monthly public meetings to keep residents informed about school business. The Gary Community School Corporation acquired distressed status after failing to pay an accumulated debt of more than $100 million and a monthly deficit of more than $18 million. The state stepped in with a bailout, offered loans, and installed an emergency manager who was charged with ensuring the district's staff size and building usage aligned with enrollment. State lawmakers passed laws in 2017 and 2018 that left Gary without a school board. Board member Robert Bug said Gary isn't the only district that's financially distressed. He alleges they're being targeted because the area is largely black. Bug says, quote, "If we were any other neighborhood, we wouldn't be having the same dialogue," end quote. Board member Darlene Pleasant said the changes were necessary, stating, quote, "No one wants to be the bad guy, but we cannot continue at the pace we are going," end quote. Hinckley's changes include withdrawing the state's contract with custodians in Service Employment International Union Local 73. She's also decided to no longer recognize the secretary's union and has required that they reapply for their jobs. Hinckley said state law only requires school districts to bargain with teacher labor groups. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Tom Maloney.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The Internal Revenue Service is moving its Miraville offices from a suburban office tower to the new Park Place retail and office building that construction was finished on late last year. It's not a far move. The IRS Taxpayer Assistance Center hopped from the Park Tower at 233 East 84th Drive in Miraville into a newly constructed 13,500-square-foot single-story building that scaled more like a strip mall across the street at 370 East 84th Drive, also in Miraville. The Legacy Foundation, displaced from the Twin Towers at US 30 and I-65 that will soon be demolished, also moved into Park Place, where more space is available for lease to offices or retailers. The IRS will open the relocated office in Miraville on June 18th. Taxpayers can visit by appointment, but can find most of the answers they're looking for online. IRS spokesman Luis Garcia said, "We strongly encourage taxpayers seeking assistance to visit our website." He goes on to say, "Most taxpayers can find the information they need or resolve their tax problem without having to visit an IRS office or even call." The IRS's Miraville Taxpayer Assistance Center will be open from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. weekdays.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Many county and city governments around Indiana will receive a share of about $21.6 million in local income tax money that the state has collected but never distributed. A letter sent late last week to local governments explained that two problems created the need for a one-time special payment. The Times reports Department of Revenue officials say the problems dated back to at least the late 1990s. Officials say the problems were found while the agency has been updating its computer systems. One issue was caused by a barcode imaging problem where the processing system didn't recognize the county of residence on some tax returns. The other problem stemmed from individuals who pay their tax bills late without filing income tax returns, which resulted in processing troubles.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
For more breaking news, here's Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney.
Five Indiana airports will share more than $13 million in federal grants to rehabilitate or extend runways. The U.S. Department of Transportation announced on Wednesday the grants are among $677 million in airport infrastructure grants the Federal Aviation Administration is awarding nationally. Four of the Indiana airports are receiving funds to rehabilitate runways. Gary International Airport in Gary is getting $4.7 million. Fort Wayne International Airport is receiving $5.4 million. Eagle Creek Air Park in Indianapolis is receiving $2.3 million. And Kokomo Municipal Airport is collecting $360,000. Paoli Municipal Airport in southern Indiana is receiving $832,500 to extend a runway. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Tom Maloney.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
For more breaking news, here's Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney.
Indiana's unemployment rate remains unchanged since February. It held steady in May at 3.2%. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the state also saw a labor force surge last month.
May marks the longest stretch Indiana's unemployment rate has gone unchanged since October of 2012. The 3.2% rate held steady since February, again equaling the lowest rate in nearly 18 years. Private sector employment rebounded after a disappointing April, adding about 1,300 jobs in May. That growth was principally driven by the financial sector. And the state's labor force boomed last month. The labor force measures not just those who have jobs, but also those actively looking for one. Growth in the labor force is often seen as a sign of optimism in the economy, and Indiana's labor force grew by nearly 16,000 Hoosiers in May. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A third school resource officer will be added in Valparaiso schools beginning July 1st. Valparaiso Police Chief Jeff Ballin made the announcement at this week's City Council meeting when asking for an appropriation of money to fund the position. Ballin said the $40,000 is coming from Valparaiso Community Schools as a reimbursement for the additional officer. Another $5,000 is being appropriated to cover uniform and other costs. The appropriation is scheduled for adoption at the Council's June 25th meeting. Ballin said this will enable the department and schools to place school resource officers full-time at the high school and each of the two middle schools. In addition to the SRO program, Ballin said they will also have an Adopt-a-School program in the district's elementary schools, which allows officers to stop by schools and interact with students.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A trial date is set for later this month for the 13-year-old boy charged in the shooting of his teacher and a fellow student at Noblesville Middle School. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle has more.
Dressed in an orange and white jumpsuit and wearing black glasses, the young defendant was led into Hamilton Circuit Court by guards. He sat at a table with his parents and attorney. He answered clearly when the magistrate asked questions. A juvenile trial is set for June 25th and 26th. Student Kylie Cook attended the hearing. She's a classmate of the defendant and says she feared for her life on the day of the shooting. She didn't know how to feel when she saw the alleged shooter walk into court.
I was more of just like a shocked and nervous because I didn't know what he was going to do or what he was going to try and say, because obviously I didn't want him to be like, oh, well, I didn't mean to do it, because you have a gun and you go to school with it, you meant to do it.
State law prohibits the student from being tried as an adult due to his age and the charges. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A Central Indiana school district has officially accepted the resignation of a teacher who disagreed with a policy compelling teachers to address transgender students by their preferred name rather than their birth name. The Brownsville Community School Corporation accepted John Klug's resignation at a school board meeting Monday, despite Klug's attempts to rescind the resignation. Klug said he submitted the tentative resignation letter last month because officials threatened to fire him over his view of the transgender name policy. He said he later tried to rescind the letter, but was denied. Klug voluntarily submitted his resignation, the district said. Board members and the superintendent declined to comment further on the decision. Klug was an orchestra teacher at Brownsville High School. He said the district's transgender name policy goes against his religious beliefs and violates his constitutional rights. Klug said he reached a compromise with school administration that allowed him to refer to all students by their last name last school year. He said administrators informed him a few months ago that he wouldn't be able to continue that practice next school year and was told that he would have to use their chosen first names or face termination. Students must have written consent from a parent and doctor to request the name change, according to district documents. LGBTQ community advocates say the practice is a sign of respect and isn't about religion or politics.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg is among the list of Democrats news outlet Political Reports met with former President Barack Obama to discuss a potential 2020 bid for the presidency. Buttigieg's communications director Mark Bodie confirmed the Indiana mayor and Obama have met several times, most recently for a, quote, informal private conversation last fall. In a statement, Bodie says Buttigieg has appreciated President Obama's interest in the South Bend region both during and since his presidency. Other Democrats who have met with the former president include Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and former Vice President Joe Biden. Politico also reports Obama met with Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti, who last year launched a nonprofit investment group in South Bend with Buttigieg's help. According to Politico, former President Obama offered advice to hopefuls on how to run for office in the midst of the current administration.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
For more breaking news, here's Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney.
United States Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in Fort Wayne Thursday to deliver remarks on the immigration priorities of the Trump administration. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Araceli Gomez Aldana reports protesters gathered outside of Parkview Field.
The protest was organized by People for the Common Good and United Activists of Fort Wayne, Indiana. Hundreds of protesters gathered outside of Parkview Field. They held up signs and chanted things like,
"This is what democracy looks like!"
and, Sarah Heineman is one of the co-founders of People for the Common Good. She was confused as to why Sessions chose Fort Wayne. She knows that the area is known to be conservative, but also has a lot of refugees, and hopes that's not why he came.
It would be a shame if he's trying to stir up divisiveness, but I think what he doesn't know is that we really thrive on diversity here.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Araceli Gomez Aldana.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana Republicans approved a party platform at their convention Saturday that defines marriage as between a man and a woman. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the vote came after an intra-party fight over that language.
The proposed 2018 platform eliminated previous language to define marriage as between a man and a woman, but a groundswell among party members prompted GOP leadership to give convention delegates an option. Vote for the 2018 language or revert back to previous language that defined marriage. Delegate Mike Simpson addressed the convention in favor of the 2018 language, which he says recognizes today's reality.
There is and are many strong families that are not centered on marriage between a man and a woman raising their own children.
But Delegate Dan Elliott told the convention the 2016 language is something previous conventions already supported.
Recognizing the reality on the ground that most families are headed by married couples.
The delegates overwhelmingly approved the 2016 language by a voice vote. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith in Evansville.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The Trump administration's newest round of steel, aluminum tariffs on Mexico and Canada have caused rebuttals. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the new taxes could hurt states, including Indiana, that have supported the president.
The tariffs would be the same as those announced against China, 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum. Canada is Indiana's and the U.S.'s largest foreign trading partner, with the Hoosier state exporting about $13 billion worth of goods there annually. World Trade Center Indianapolis President Doris Ann Sadler says the move could negatively impact efforts her organization and Governor Eric Holcomb have made, attracting additional Canadian investment in the Hoosier state.
One day they're on, one day they're off kind of discussion, and that was businesses to be reluctant to enter into trade deals.
The European Union is also included in the most recent round of tariffs and has, like the others, announced retaliatory levies on U.S. goods. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana recycling experts say changing rules in China are negatively impacting United States exports of those materials. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, this problem could create an opportunity for Indiana, but at a cost.
Trump administration tariffs on steel and aluminum are hurting industries caught in the crossfire. Adina Renee Adler directs the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries and says a trade war has been detrimental to the recycling business, too.
It's just that the practical reality is that China has retaliated and they included a 25% import tariff on aluminum scrap.
Indiana does not export much of its recyclable materials and has had to develop its own infrastructure to handle them. Indiana Recycling Coalition Executive Director Allison Mitchell says if state leaders choose to spend the money on improving Indiana's capacity to refine the waste it generates, manufacturers in the state could buy those recyclables rather than having to spend more money importing them from elsewhere. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson supports the voter purge method halted by a federal judge this week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Lawson defended the system to delegates at the Indiana GOP convention.
A federal judge ruled Indiana's voter purge system likely violates federal law. The day after that decision, Secretary of State Connie Lawson told state GOP delegates it was designed to make it harder to cheat.
Some Democrats are attacking me, claiming that the list cleanup process isn't fair, and alleging that we are suppressing voters or removing legitimate voters from the voter rolls. That's categorically false.
But her opponent in this year's general election, Democrat Jim Harper, says it is about voter suppression.
I think that that sends a message that our current leadership isn't taking Hoosiers' right to vote seriously.
The state hasn't said whether it will appeal the judge's decision. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana health experts are pushing for more state funding to address problems including the opioid epidemic, tobacco use, and high infant mortality rates. The Journal Gazette reports that doctors, community leaders, and public health policy experts discussed health-related topics Tuesday at a forum hosted by the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana. Allen County Health Commissioner Dr. Deborah McMahon says the state doesn't put enough money into public health. The America's Health Rankings 2017 says Indiana spends less than $62 per resident in public health funding. A recent report from the United Health Foundation says Indiana has some of the highest rates of tobacco use and obesity. Dr. Tony Giacinta is president of the Indiana American Academy of Pediatrics. He says the state should increase cigarette taxes and use that revenue to boost public health efforts. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Its design is sleek and discreet, fitting just inside the palm of your hand and mimics the look of a flash drive. The Juul e-cigarette is marketed online for adult smokers as a satisfying alternative to cigarettes, but the device is gaining the attention of just the opposite demographic, non-smoking youth and young adults. Lakeshore Public Radio's Valerie Plenovich reports.
Since its launch in 2015, the Juul, spelled J-U-U-L, has taken over the market for electronic cigarettes, better known as e-cigarettes. According to a Nielsen data report, the Juul achieved 46.8% of the e-cigarette market share this past April. The rapid market growth is said to be spurred by the brand's decision to heavily market on social media platforms like Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Juul Labs Incorporated states on their website that the Juul was created to be a satisfying alternative to cigarettes, and its mission is to improve the lives of adult smokers. However, it is quickly gaining popularity among youth and young adults across the nation and here in Indiana. According to the director of the Tobacco Prevention and Cessation Division of the Indiana State Department of Health, Miranda Spitznagel, youth and young adult use of e-cigarettes and vaping devices, including the Juul, have been a concern for quite some time, and it's a problem that the department is keeping close tabs on.
Our most current data, which are from 2016, can tell us that 10.5% of high school students report current use of an electronic cigarette. And so that's certainly something that we're paying attention to.
Spitznagel also stated that the department is monitoring the use of the Juul in particular because of its higher concentration of nicotine. Each interchangeable Juul pod contains around 200 puffs, which is equal to one pack of cigarettes. The Juul is also said to deliver a nicotine peak in just 5 minutes, a feature that is attracting both youth and adult smokers.
Nicotine is a highly addictive substance. And as we are concerned and monitoring the use of these products, concerned about youth using these products, mostly because young brains are still developing into their early 20s, and use and exposure to nicotine is something that could disrupt adolescent brain development and increase the susceptibility of further addiction.
Former Northwest Indiana resident Morgan Jackson has a more positive perspective and experience with the use of e-cigarettes. She began smoking at age 16, and within 2 years, she was smoking a pack a day. While looking for nicotine alternatives to help her quit, she found that e-cigarettes were the best option for her.
I didn't crave cigarettes. It kept my hands busy. It fulfilled the nicotine I needed, and I've since then dropped the nicotine levels down and gone to a simpler e-cig, and I still haven't had a cigarette in about 8 months.
However, she too has noticed the Juul's rising popularity and became aware of the product by her 20-year-old brother when she first started using e-cigarettes. She voiced her concern, saying that he was never a nicotine product user before the Juul was created.
I would say he's addicted to nicotine now, and he was never a smoker.
The health department has a large network of local tobacco control coalitions across many counties in Indiana, including Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties, that are actively working on preventing situations similar to Jackson's brother's from happening. These coalitions work with community leaders, organizations, and schools to educate and bring awareness to tobacco products, which include the Juul e-cigarette. They also recommend that schools and other organizations change their tobacco-free grounds policies to include electronic smoking devices.
A free resource to anyone in the state of Indiana is the Indiana Tobacco Quit Line, which is the number 1-800-QUIT-NOW. And anyone ages 13 and over can call that number and get free help for quitting tobacco use. And it is an effective, safe, confidential way to quit tobacco use.
Juul Labs Incorporated openly prohibits underage use of the e-cigarette, and their website states that they are working on developing and pioneering both technology and programs focused on the prevention of underage use of their products. This includes reaching out to schools, law enforcement, and youth prevention initiatives. Juul Labs Incorporated was contacted, but no response was received. This is Valerie Plenovich, Lakeshore Public Radio.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A breed of high-tech fish is coming to Indiana, and the company producing it hopes to change the aqua science industry. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, biotech salmon could be the first genetically modified animal to be sold for human consumption.
Near no major body of water, the small town of Albany, Indiana will soon be home to a new salmon production facility. As unlikely as the location is, the fish is just as unusual. Massachusetts-based Aqua Bounty will produce a GMO salmon that CEO Ron Stottish says will grow faster than fish raised in fresh water.
It does so because we've given it the ability, using the same biological process that regulates growth in the unmodified salmon, to grow about twice as fast, reaching market weight in about half the time.
The technology has been around since the 1990s, but it took until 2015 to receive approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration due to concerns about people eating genetically modified animals. University of California Davis genomics professor Allison von Inanum testified to the FDA as it was considering Aqua Bounty's case. She says that the protein in the fish is the same as other freshwater salmon and poses no human consumption risk.
You know, as an animal breeder, we breed for fast-growing animals all the time. I mean, if you look at a chicken today versus 50 years ago, you know, they grow more rapidly through conventional breeding, and this is just using biotech to do the same things.
Stottish contends his operation causes less harm than traditional fish farming.
We're not using coastal waterways. We're not putting antibiotics and medications into the water. Our fish are in a controlled environment. We don't need antibiotics. We don't have to treat for sea lice. You'll see in the tanks, there are barriers.
On a tour of the facility, Stottish shows several precautions made to prevent any fish from escaping.
This is the most contained facility probably anywhere in the world, anywhere in the industry. This is above and beyond anything that exists.
UC Davis's Allison von Inanum says the fish's genetic makeup also makes it unlikely they'd survive, let alone breed, outside the plant.
The fish cannot get out into wild, into the ocean, and they're also being raised as females and triploid, which makes them infertile. And so that really is a containment approach to prevent any escapement and interbreeding with the wild fish populations.
But Aqua Bounty has to swim against the current of groups that oppose the biotech fish due to environmental and health concerns. Consumers Union senior scientist Michael Hansen worries the bar has been set too low when it comes to genetically modified animals. He says the tests done to show the fish are safe were inadequate.
So rather than realize that they had a bad test because they couldn't detect anything, rather than do that, both the company and the agency concluded from that data that there were no differences in growth hormone levels between the treated and untreated fish.
But Stada says his company is a pioneer in an increasingly crowded world.
There aren't enough terrestrial resources or aquatic resources to be able to meet the protein needs of those 9 billion people.
Still, stores such as Kroger, Target, and Aldi have already announced they will not sell Aqua Bounty's biotech salmon. The Albany facility, which used to be a conventional fish farm, is still being renovated as company leaders wait on an import alert to be lifted so GMO salmon eggs may be brought from Canada into the U.S. Once the eggs arrive at the facility, it will take about 18 months before the first batch of fish is ready to go to market. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Over the last couple of decades, research shows the number of teens getting behind the wheel is down significantly, but it's difficult to know exactly why. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports, there is some evidence to show that more recently, the trend could be reversing.
Jalen Mann is a junior at Indiana University. He's your average college student, except when it comes to one aspect of his life. He doesn't have a driver's license.
I do have a learner's permit, but that's only because I needed a form of ID for my 21st birthday.
Mann prefers walking. He says, unlike his friends, he just never took an interest in driving, and he still gets picked on for it. It shows as he and his roommate talk about it in the kitchen.
Didn't you feel bad, like asking them all the time, hey, can you pick me up? Hey, can I get a ride? Oh, I want to go hang out.
They'll just kind of look at me for a second and be like, you don't even have a license. I don't know what you're talking. Like, you shouldn't be talking or contributing to the conversation.
Although it sounds unusual, Mann isn't the only one skipping out on the typical 16-year-old's dream. According to a study published in the journal Child Development, in the late 1970s, 88% of high school seniors had a driver's license. That's dropped to about 73% during the past several years. The reason for the significant drop in adolescents driving isn't exactly clear. But Greg Sider, the public affairs manager with the Hoosier Motor Club, says it seems the economy plays a big role.
The finances involved in not only obtaining a license, but then in driving a vehicle, those numbers in and of themselves were what we believe were pulling kids away from wanting to get their license.
Sider says the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety found the biggest reason for teens holding off on getting their license is that they don't have a car.
There's obviously a direct connection in the ability of teenagers being able to find jobs or to have some sort of income and connecting that then to their willingness and eagerness to obtain a driver's license.
Put in the ignition, go ahead and start it up, but let's not do anything else yet.
Bernard Sissel has been teaching driver education for the last 20 years. As he sits in the passenger seat, he gives detailed instructions while one of his students operates the car.
Let's go left up here into the lot.
Sissel says he loves working with the teens.
Driver education is one of those things. If they're taking driver ed, they're certainly interested in the subject material and they're wanting to learn.
But he says there are a number of reasons teens put off this rite of passage.
It could be because, you know, there's not a need in the family. There may, you know, mom drives, dad drives, they got an older brother, sister that drives, and maybe they just don't have the interest to want to learn.
Not only is driver education expensive, costing at least a few hundred dollars, he says it's not as accessible as it used to be because it was previously mandated by the Department of Education.
Back years ago, all the high schools had their own driver education program, and it was typically the physical education department staff that would go out and teach the kids as a regular part of the school day.
That's not the case anymore, and Sissel says that makes it more challenging for teens. But Sider says recent car accident data shows a possible uptick in the number of teens getting their licenses.
Because there are more teenagers being involved in accidents on the roadway, we can take from that that there are more teenagers driving. So that's a variable right there.
While that's an anecdotal example of how the trend could be changing, it's unclear if that's what's really happening. And still, there are many people like Mann, the college student who loves to walk everywhere, who don't have a specific reason for not getting their license. They just simply have no desire. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
Driver education is not required in the state of Indiana, but it does dictate when a driver can get their license. These days, there are online options out there, which makes it more accessible. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Residents of 13 counties in Indiana, including several in the region, have more time until July 5th to apply for disaster assistance caused by flooding that occurred between February 14th and March 4th of this year. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with FEMA spokesperson William Lindsay about the process.
So can you tell me why the add-on for the counties, the additional counties that are now available for the federal assistance?
Well, FEMA's been in the area ever since the flooding that occurred on February 14th through March 4th. That's considered the critical incident period. So if anyone has sustained any damages or losses during that time, we want them to register with FEMA as soon as possible. Now, we have added an additional 13 counties because we are taking advisements and doing all types of disaster assessments with our local and county stakeholders as emergency managers. And they've determined that there is a need in the additional 13 counties.
So how do people register for this assistance if they need it?
Well, the fastest way to register with FEMA is to go to our website, which is www.disasterassistance.gov. And at that site, we also have a lot of information as far as mitigation. We have a lot of information on our programs. Now, the other thing that we do is that we have our disaster survival assistance personnel, and they go door to door, making sure that anyone in the affected area is contacted and know what their recovery resources are and what's available. Now, that website, again, is disasterassistance.gov, or you can call our 1-800 number at 1-800-621-3362.
Under what circumstances are people eligible for this assistance?
Well, during that incident period, Valentine's Day, February 14th through March 4th, if they sustain any losses to their residents, any personal losses if they're renters, businesses can also get assistance through our partner, the Small Business Administration. So we bring in a whole bunch of other federal and local government resources to be able to render this type of assistance to those who need it. But it has to have occurred during that period. Now, we know it's been a long time since then. However, we're still out there, still determining that there are still people out there, survivors rather, who need this valuable recovery resources.
Now, once you apply, how long does it take to get your recovery resources?
Well, that's, you know, you've probably heard this before, you know, case-by-case jargon coming from the government, but that's really what we do. It's a case-by-case situation because every person, every household that has sustained any kind of damages, that's a very specific issue to that particular case. So our first thing is to have you registered with us, and then we will send out inspectors. We will be able to look over what the damages are because most people have already taken photos of that situation. So if you have those photos, you have those receipts for items that you may have incurred during that time, we want you to share those with us as well.
Does it guarantee that you're eligible, that you're going to get the assistance just by applying?
No, this is federal dollars. These are taxpayer dollars that we use to render these resources. So we are cognizant of what this money is going toward and for. So if you have legitimate needs or you have legitimate losses, you are the person we want to hear from.
Okay. Is there any kind of top out, the most that you'll pay out?
Well, our thing is we don't duplicate insurance programs, so we won't be duplicating your insurance adjusters, or a lot of people are underinsured, and that's what this money is for. And as far as a top rate there, we don't want to go into specifics with that because that varies.
Can you tell me which Northwest Indiana counties are eligible? Can you name them?
Right now, we have Lake County, St. Joseph. We have Carroll, White. Those are the areas that I am covering right now, and I'm waiting for additional counties to come on board. So I was just in Plymouth this morning down there because we have a disaster recovery center in place. And what you also see throughout the affected areas is that our mitigation teams will be set up at area Lowe's and Home Depot's, and they will be supplying those who have had losses on how to rebuild, how to mitigate for a possible next situation. So we're always trying to make our living spaces stronger to be able to adapt to any type of disasters. And that's what you'll find on our website, disasterassistance.gov, a whole lot of information on what to do.
So mitigate meaning like how to build so it doesn't happen again?
Exactly, exactly. What precautions to take. Also, you get advice on how to hire contractors. And one thing we have to say is that, you know, disaster fraud is something that is a reality in our country. Well, I travel all over the nation doing emergency management, and we do have a lot of predators out there. So anyone that you may encounter who says that they are a FEMA representative or a local county emergency management representative, if they ask for any type of financial compensation, that's your first red flag that they are not legitimate. And we ask that you call your local law enforcement agency immediately.
Is there anything else that you want to tell me that maybe I haven't asked you about?
Well, one thing is that we know that Indianans are very resourceful. And we also know that as far as the registration, a lot of people are waiting. The registration deadline is July 5th. So you have a little bit of time, but don't wait. Let's get this process going, because that's what it is. It's a process. And there's a lot of curves to this process. And that's our way of being good stewards of taxpayer dollars. So if you had disasters, or maybe you have experience in a previous disaster here in Indiana, we ask that you help your neighbor, help them wade through the waters, if you will, of the FEMA process. They're not that difficult. A lot of people think that if they are told that, well, at this time, we need to see you to talk about your application. It's not a denial. It's just that we need to talk about certain things that you may have left out of your application. And a lot of times that can be that you didn't sign the portion that renders aid from the Small Business Administration. That is very crucial. A lot of people don't want a loan at this particular point, but we want them to know their full extent of their recovery resources. So once that form is not signed, we have to stop and then contact you to let you know that we want you to sign that form. You don't have to take a loan, but we want you to know your full extent of your recovery resources.
I'm not sure I understand what you're talking about, loan. I thought this was, it's not a loan, is it?
Well, see, that's the issue. FEMA has, well, basically grants. These are recovery resources, and that's taxpayer dollars. But the Small Business Administration, they come into play because a lot of people are underinsured, and they may want additional monies to be able to mitigate their residence. We don't provide monies for replacement of cars and buildings that are away from their domicile. So the home that you sleep in, that's our primary concern. And also we hope that you have flood insurance. A lot of folks don't have flood insurance. And that's where SBA, Small Business Administration, can come in with assistance as well.
So when would a loan come into play?
Well, just like that. If you're underinsured and you need help with rebuilding, they have very low interest loans for you. However, with FEMA, our mandate is to make sure that we return you to a safe and clean, nurturing home environment. So if you have your clothing is lost, we have a whole lot of programs there with Salvation Army, with the Red Cross, with the Catholic Charities. A lot of volunteer organizations come to play in our time of need to support FEMA's mission. So FEMA gives what's grants. So any money that you get from FEMA, you don't have to pay back. But our partner, the Small Business Administration, they provide monies for any type of improvements above what FEMA is able to give out.
Oh, I understand. Okay, thank you for explaining that.
Well, and one thing is that you may hear about individual assistance. Well, individual assistance is for the homeowner, resident, renter. Public assistance is for the infrastructure. That's the road buildings, bridges, libraries, water concerns, electrical concerns, anything to deal with the government side of the infrastructure.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sharon Jackson.
That's FEMA spokesperson William Lindsay speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. Anyone wanting to apply for disaster relief assistance should go to disasterassistance.gov. The deadline to apply is July 5th. Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Jamie Williams, Director of Marketing of Ameristar Casino.
Jamie, if you will, tell us a little bit about the planning that Ameristar and the parent company had thought about ahead of time, maybe even before the General Assembly went ahead and changed the rules to allow for construction of facilities on land as opposed to being strictly on the boat.
Well, the planning has been going on for quite a long time. It's, you know, once landside gaming was a thought in Indiana, the companies have looked at and said, hey, if we could build on land, where would we build? What would we do? Once the law was passed in 2015, it was full steam ahead. The planning started thinking about what was the best space to use, what would be the best for our customers to make it the room that we wanted it to be. And here we are, you know, over 2 years later with the opening of the room, close to 3 years it took.
Okay. If you will describe what the thoughts were, I guess, with the facility that you had before and now, what you've taken now and turned into this new gaming area.
The area that the High Limit Room is in kind of encompassed three or four different areas. We had a restaurant there, Burger Brothers, which is moving to the pavilion. We had a credit office. Our My Choice area was there, but it was only open on the weekends. So most of the space was underutilized. It was closed for part of the week, maybe used a day here and there. So it really became the ideal location to say this would be a great place to put our High Limit Room for our guests.
Now, how much room was there available to be able to do everything that you've done now to it?
The room is about 15,000 square feet, so once we knocked down some walls and kind of combined the spaces, it really allowed us to create a comfortable environment with the right number of machines and tables for our customers.
Now, before you actually had a chance to use this space to make this new facility, where were some of the other high-stakes games and the other facilities located when they had to be on the boat?
They were separated on the boat, so our High Limit Table Game Room was located on the second floor of the vessel all the way to the front section, and our High Limit Slot Room was directly above it on the third level. They were smaller spaces, not as many amenities, harder to service, and probably not as comfortable for our customers.
Were they very, very busy rooms? As I'm saying, it's probably relatively so compared to the rest of the casino.
They were busy. You know, when you have certain high-stakes games, they're not going to be as busy as the regular casino floor. But we held our own. We had a lot of players who enjoyed the rooms, who came and were very loyal to Ameristar. And this was something that we could do for them as well to make a better space for them to come and game in.
Okay. Well, Jamie, take us now through the process. The casino has the permission to go ahead and get the plans going that have been thought of ahead of time for what you want to do on land. Take us through the process of the actual construction and getting ready to open up the facility and how it's done so far.
Well, the construction process, just like any process, there's going to be bumps and bruises. We started this process in early January and closing down the existing areas that were operating out of the current room, found new homes for them, and the construction process started. So it's been about five and a half months in the making. Like I said, some bumps and bruises along the way, but I think when you start tearing down walls anywhere, you're going to find that. So after 5.5 months, you know, we started thinking about when the room would open, the timing of it, making sure our customers knew, inviting them, showcasing the room. And the feedback that we've gotten since we opened on May 24th has been phenomenal. The guests love the space. They love the environment, the service. You know, their favorite team members from the old rooms are working the new rooms, and those are people that they've built wonderful relationships with. But just the fact that everything they need is located in one space now, and it's convenient for them to get to, we've had a lot of positive feedback so far.
Now, as we're speaking here on Friday, you're getting ready for some special events that you can also, I guess, take advantage of this special room for, too.
Yeah, this room allows us to really showcase special events for our customers. We have the third leg of a Triple Crown table game tournament going on this Saturday. So we have our blackjack portion featuring the high limit room that starts tomorrow. And then we have a promotion every Saturday right now for our high limit slot players where we're giving away free money every Saturday night. So they come in and they enjoy that. The room also features some buffet stations. So during these special events, we're able to offer food for our customers. So again, they don't have to leave the room for anything. Mm-hmm.
Now, besides having these special events and the opportunities that they're going to present to bring in people that maybe have never either been to the casino boat completely, or certainly not to what the changes have allowed them to be able to do, how easy is it now to attract people to come over to Ameristar now, especially in the light of the fact that we have so many boats in the region?
Well, you know, I think we have a little bit of an edge up. We have a beautiful hotel room here. Our guests can come in and stay right on property. Our rooms are spacious, over 500 square feet, offer all the amenities that you can think of. And then it's just a short walk to the casino floor from our hotel. With the restaurants that we offer, from fine dining to sports bars, casual dining, there's really nothing that our guests would have to leave the property for. So I feel that we can offer them a full package of once they get here, everything they need is here. And now on top of it, there's an exceptional high limit experience for them to take advantage of.
I know that some of the other casinos here in the region are making announcements of plans for expansion and the like. So whether they're not been spurred on because of what Ameristar has already done, it's something I guess you have to keep your eye on. You have to keep an eye out for what the competition's doing, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's, you know, in any business, you always have to keep an eye on what your customers or your competition are doing. And, you know, to be the leader in that is always a good feeling to know that, you know, we were first to market and that we were able to provide a different and unique experience for our customers. And I think our customers appreciate that we've taken their feedback and their thoughts into consideration when we've built the room. And since we've opened, you know, minor adjustments we've made to the room, it's important that our customers feel comfortable and that they enjoy the space, because that's what's going to keep them coming back, even if the competition tries to replicate something that we've done.
I know that probably the closest it's going to be to a big project, I would imagine, is what the folks over in Gary are planning to do. They want to take advantage of the opportunity to be located on land, and they're probably wanting to do a complete relocation if they can. So you have to, I say, you have to keep an eye out for what the other casinos in the region are doing, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we always do keep an eye on what they're doing. We like to be aggressive in what we're doing, and we feel that we have a great package that we can offer to our guests, and the service that we provide is exceptional, and that's what's going to keep them coming back. But, you know, the competition is always going to be changing, just like we are, so we keep an eye on it, but we try to focus really on what we're doing and servicing our customers and making sure when they come here they have the best experience.
Are there any other plans that Ameristar Casino here in East Chicago would like to be able to take advantage of now that you've gotten this new high-stakes room open, ready for business, and it's already being well used?
You know, there's always going to be thoughts and brainstorming of what the next move is. Right now, we're continuing with a remodel of our entire casino floor, so every floor on the vessel is getting redone and updated, and it's something that our customers are definitely going to appreciate. So that's our current project right now. You know, it's about a $16 million project. So when that's all done, you know, obviously we'll take a look and always be thinking about what the next opportunity is.
Jamie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Jamie Williams is the Director of Marketing for Ameristar Casino here in East Chicago. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.